Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics Question Time with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell. And Rory, can I start with an apology?
Oh, yeah.
Not to you. Well, I guess to you, partly, because you know I don't like getting my facts wrong.
Yep.
Liz Trump, no relation, as Brits listening in Brussels.
What a great name, Liz Trump. That's a great name.
Well, I mean, it's sort of, if Truss and Trump had a baby, I mean, oh, God, no, horrible thought. Liz Trump, as Brits listening in Brussels, we love your podcast. We ended up shouting in the kitchen whilst listening to your latest episode, in which you discussed female authors. Amélie Nothomb is Belgian, not French. She was born in our commune of Etterbeek, also famous for the European institutions Stromae, Hergé, Marouane Fellaini, and Herman Van Rompuy. Who's Marouane Fellaini, Rory?
I don't know.
He's a footballer, Rory. I knew that one. So anyway, I really do apologise, Liz, and you weren't the only one to get in touch to say that I assumed Amélie was French. She is Belgian. That means that my favourite French language current writer, my favourite current football manager, Vincent Kompany, and my favourite all-time singer, Jack Brel, are all Belgians. So I hope that makes up for my faux pas.
But we will have to do something on Belgium.
Yeah, we should.
I mean, I think she goes on to say, love to hear your thoughts on how a country can exist and function so well, despite half the population not being able to understand the other half, Flemish stroke French, with an elite professional class in Brussels able to provide bilingual education, hence access to all the best, highest paid jobs, which demand two or three languages. Also, why is it the Brits are so poor at languages compared to the rest of Europe?
I can mention another book there. My friend Tom Baldwin and Mark Sears have co-written. Tom's the guy who wrote the book about Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
They've written another book now called England, and it's about seven myths that have sort of, you know, driven our politics to the place that it's in and the country. And I think, you know, the answer to the question, why are Brits so poor at languages, is because we just assume that we're superior.
Right. We must do something on Belgium. I think it'd be fun to do something on Belgium. Listen, here's a question on the Maldives from Kerry. Can you please discuss the recent election in the Maldives and what it might mean for their relationship with China? Quick explainer before I come to you on the election. So Maldives, tiny place, 500,000 people, and a massive kind of Cold War between India and China, where quite literally the Chinese will build some enormous bridge called the China-Maldives Bridge, and then India will build an even more enormous bridge called the India-Maldives Bridge. And it's become vital because China sees this island as being a great refueling point and strategic base in the sea. And of course, India, who's much closer to the Maldives, also sees it as vital for its maritime security. The country is basically an island that makes most of its money off tourism. I mean, like 95% of its money off tourism. Lovely place, I think, to go on holiday. Not that I've never actually been there. Have you been there? Into Maldives?
No.
Anyway, maybe we should go to Maldives to follow.
We're going to do Belgium, and now we're going to do a special Rest Is Politics in the Maldives. Right.
That's right. Important to follow up. Anyway, and China, of course, tends to spend more money than India, has poured in more money, but because India's closer, it's able to put more ratcheting on security. And this has translated into political parties in the Maldives basically being very nakedly either pro-China or pro-India. And my understanding is the pro-Chinese party in the Maldives just won a landslide. Is that right?
Essentially, this is a big win for Beijing. So the president, Mohamed Mouitsou, absolute landslide. They won 70 out of 93 seats, which means they've got massive control. And as you say, it was pretty much, there are obviously lots of different domestic issues, But the opposition party, the MDP, led by an ex-president, a guy called Ibrahim Mohamed Soli, who we've talked about before, he is seen as very, very pro-India. And he won 15 seats against 65. So that is all a big, big yes, thumbs up to the president's plan to plow ahead with much, much closer cooperation with China. And, you know, that is quite a big deal.
And I think just a reminder of something we sometimes talk about. I mean, so the Chinese economy is obviously in big, big trouble. It's going to struggle to grow. Huge problems around the property market, huge problems around aging. But it would be a real mistake to conclude from that China's international power is really waning. Mm. In fact, what we can see with these kinds of things and in many other places around the world, that China is still the second largest economy in the world, the largest exporter in the world, the largest manufacturer in the world. And even if it's getting older and its economy isn't growing so fast, it continues to increase its power dramatically in many, many parts of the world. I mean, we've seen that, you know, it still remains very strong in Africa, and I would argue has actually strengthened its position against the US and Africa over the last 4 years. So there's a lot going on here, as you can imagine, in the States, of everybody trying to talk about how China's economy is weak. But it reminds me a little bit of people saying, you know, this was something Obama did, saying Russia's economy was so weak and it was getting so old in 2014 that it wasn't really a threat to the world. This idea that there's a direct connection between your economic growth and your demography and whether or not you're a major security player, I think is a mistake. I think China is actually, even as its economy struggles to grow, I think it's flexing its international muscles more and more.
And there is a security element to this as well, as there was in the recent election in the Solomon Islands. And the government has actually asked, there are many, many Indian military personnel who are there, and they operate Indian Renaissance aircraft to essentially patrol in the country's borders. And the president has asked them to leave. Now, where are they going to get that security from in the future? Well, maybe they'll go to China.
Yeah.
So these things, we may think of a small country that's rightly obsessed about climate change because that's such a sort of existential threat. But all of these smaller countries now tend to be caught up in these bigger geostrategic struggles. By the way, just briefly on Modi, Rory, I don't know if you saw it. I sent you a thing about an Australian journalist, television journalist, who's been essentially kicked out of India because they don't like the reporting.
I suddenly got just a very, very thin glimpse into Modi's cyber warriors when I was critical about Modi on The Rest Is Politics with you a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
It is impressive, or slightly worrying, what an incredible social media army he has to attack anyone who dares to criticize.
Absolutely. I suspect that means that that Sadiq Khan will be getting the same treatment, because of course he was quite critical, wasn't he, when we interviewed him on Leading the other day.
Yeah. That'll be interesting for him. You were in Singapore, and here's a question about Singapore from somebody called Martin. You just got back from Singapore.
Yep.
Both of you have waxed lyrical in your praise of Singapore's approach to government. It would be nice to hear alongside this praise the acknowledgement that it's a pseudo-democracy that's been ruled by a single family for almost its entire existence. How do you balance your praise for Singapore with its notorious intolerance of dissent that would be viewed as routine in any actual democracy? I don't think he means routine. Maybe something outrageous in any actual democracy. Yeah.
Well, the first point about the family, so Lee Kuan Yew, the original founder, it is true that his son is the current prime minister who is stepping down. But you'd be very hard-pressed to find anybody, including well beyond Singapore, who doesn't think that Lee Kuan Yew was an extraordinary leader and who built this incredible success story. And likewise, anybody who's ever met the son, Lee Hsien Loong, who is about to go, he's one of the cleverest political leaders I've ever met. So I don't think you could say he's only there because he is the son. And likewise, there have been other prime ministers in between, and there's going to be another one starting soon, Lawrence Wong. And I think that sometimes I can see why, from a purely Western perspective, you can say, well, you know, they have pretty easy time with the media. They're a pretty government. This is very, very strong government and so forth. But it's certainly not. It is a democracy in that there are opposition parties who are in parliament, who have freedom to campaign and do campaign. And I must I must, Rory, can I briefly read you a letter? You know, I told you recently that one of my favorite ministers out there, a guy called Sean by everybody, but he's the Minister of Law, K. Shanmugam.
Was he the guy that kindly was reading my book?
He was reading your book and he told you how he was sending pictures of pages of your book to colleagues in the civil service and in the ministries and in the government to say, this is, you know, he loved the book. And anyway, the reason I wanted to draw him to your attention again is because The Economist did an editorial recently about Singapore that was very much on the lines of our questioner. Very, very, you know, questioning a lot about Singapore's success and standards, etc. So let me just read you Sean's Facebook post. The Economist cannot resist sneering. It's an instinct lodged deep in the unconscious of the British commentariat class. They cannot stand that a people they were accustomed to lecturing are now doing better than they are across the board. Take governance. Lawrence Wong will be our fourth prime minister in 59 years. Meanwhile, in the UK, Mr. Rishi Sunak is their fourth prime minister in 4.9 years. Mr. Boris Johnson, when he was prime minister, accepted a holiday worth £15,000 and £50,000 for renovations from donors. In Singapore, anyone who did that would have been charged in court. Or the economy. We started as a British colony with per capita GDP of $500. Now it's more than 80,000. We have the fifth highest GDP per capita in the world, well ahead of the UK. On our media, The Economist refers to our docile press. It obviously prefers a situation like in the UK, where one person can control major media outlets and have politicians pay court to him, and where media owners can influence who gets elected and who becomes prime minister. A similar situation in Australia was described by a former prime minister as a cancer on democracy. And he goes on and on and on, and finally says, in social cohesion, in the UK, a Tory party donor recently said of a black MP that looking at her makes him want to hate all black women. His party said, all should just move on from the comments. That's it. In Singapore, a person who made such a comment would be charged in court. What price your sneer? Pretty good.
There we are. We should link to the Economist article, which makes clearly the other case on this. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, I was obviously I'm speaking to you from Yale where I'm teaching at the moment, and I've got a Rwandan student here who makes similar arguments for Rwanda, which has had a very, very impressive economic development story since the 90s, along with an authoritarian government. And it's a real question. I mean, repeated again and again through the developing world, which is, if a government is able to deliver really dramatic improvements in people's social and economic conditions and does it with a more authoritarian, less democratic method of government, how do you get your head around that? Because we were brought up to believe that there was an easy going together, no choices to be made, that liberal democracy and economic growth were natural partners.
Yeah.
But of course, most dramatically of all, China is a situation where 700 million people were lifted out of extreme poverty. There's been this most incredible economic growth without there being a democracy. And I think this is one of the issues when, you know, when you look at opinion polls in the Middle East and in Africa, people increasingly will say that they prefer the Singaporean system or the system in Dubai, for example, which is another authoritarian state, to Britain, France, the United States. So it's a really raw nerve where I think those of us that believe in liberal democracy need to make a much, much clearer, better case.
You know, we've talked before, and I've written about John Major's speech that he made a while back, you know, In Democracy We Trust? And he basically says there is an arrogance to the democracies that we assume that we're just better. And the feeling I always get when I go to Singapore is when you talk to people, the politicians, they are very, very, very conscious, in a way that I think a lot of our politicians are not, of delivery. In other words, they feel if they have to be delivering according to the priorities that they've set out, they have to be delivering good public services, they have to be delivering on the economy and so forth. And they are very, very, very conscious of the arguments that are pushed their way by the opposition. And also, if you do have to look at where they are in the world, very, very different place to where we are. And so I think it's easy, as Sean says, it is easy to sneer. And it is easy to make the case that, you know, they're not necessarily running the same way that our democracy does. But at the same time, I think in terms of where they've come from to where they've got to as a democracy, it's a very, very impressive story.
Listen, I mean, there are serious constraints on the media and serious constraints on other political parties. But one of their biggest achievements was on corruption. I mean, it's made it very, very powerful example in a region where there is endemic corruption that Singapore basically managed to eliminate corruption almost entirely. I mean, it's less corrupt than Britain. Here's a little nerdy question from Kieran Ward that I liked, because sometimes people want us to talk about the nerdy details of politics. Does the House of Commons have a seating plan? I often see my MP, Chris Elmore, standing by the Speaker and many other MPs squeezed like sardines on the benches. I know the front bench obviously sits in an order, but not sure how it works in the rows behind. Actually, the truth is, there's absolutely no seating plan. So, and the benches are deliberately designed to not be able to hold all the MPs, because when it was bombed during the war, there was an idea of going back to a system of actually having enough room for everybody. And Churchill said, no, he really liked the sense of the hubbub. So I spent a lot of my early years sitting on the stairs, not actually on a chair. And even when you're a cabinet minister, there's no seating plan. I mean, broadly speaking, the prime minister and the chancellor get to sit in the middle, the more senior ministers.
I think you're overlooking the deputy prime minister, Mr. Oliver Dowden. I think the deputy prime minister might get there as well.
We're also overlooking the deputy prime minister, Mr. Oliver Dowden. But otherwise, you come in and you squeeze in. And a lot of it, of course, is so your constituents can see you on telly. Mm. So there was a lot of push. You'll notice often behind the prime minister or behind the leader of the opposition will be the sort of rising stars of the party that people want to get on television and show. And in the early days of the Cameron government, it was often an opportunity for Cameron to show diversity in the new intake with the people that he would sit behind him, and they would be captured on the media.
I used to get very angry if ever there was a shot of the front bench, say whether it was Tony Blair or a minister at the front bench, if the Commons was busy and there were no women or people of colour behind. I think that was something we thought of. But there is a sort of informal placement. I know that, for example, across the, so you've got the, where you've got the dispatch box, and then the Dennis Skinner, who's an absolute veteran, used to always have the same place, and every other MP.
The beast of Bolsover.
Absolutely. Every other MP, if they were sitting there, knew that if he came in, they would move up. Likewise, I think Ted Heath had a place when he was on the back benches that I think Theresa May has now. I think I noticed that she always sits in the same place. And I wonder if she's already established that if she comes into the Commons and somebody's sitting there, they shuffle up a bit.
That's right. Very senior people. And the father of the house often had a kind of set position. But no, you're right. I mean, apart from these kind of few kind of legendary big figures, the rest of us largely kind of
squeeze in where you can.
Shuffling. Although we try to, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg made a sort of system right from the moment he arrived of, has this incredible kind of lounging where he's almost lying on the bench, and he used to sit right at the end of the chamber, kind of sort of drag himself, unfold himself onto his feet. And then you've got the whips who often stand behind the speaker's chair so they can't be seen from the television cameras, trying to sort of whip up people into these kind of football chants. So you can see them kind of conducting from the back of the speaker's chair, trying to get people to shout, "Hear, hear."
Yeah. Okay, Rory, loads more questions to come. Take a quick break.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator," I said, "you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, here's one from Sal, which has been, the issue has been angering me for days. Why on earth would Labour dismiss out of hand Europe's offer to talk about free movement for 80 to 30-year-olds for 4 years? Sal goes on, I'm thinking of ending my membership and voting Lib Dem because of this, though I know it will be a wasted vote in my constituency. It's so infuriating. I guess the straight answer to the question, why on earth would Labour dismiss out of hand, is because they don't want anything which allows the Tories to make a big deal about Labour trying to shift their position on Europe, because that will then allow them to, as it were, reopen the Brexit debate. I agree with Sal. I think that to dismiss it out of hand at a time when there are so many difficulties arriving from the government's Brexit deal that have to be fixed, I found very, very depressing.
Well, it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, and it's such a good proposal, and it's such a defensible proposal, and it hits a particular group of people in a really useful way. I guess the only thing, I presumably Keir Starmer might have been a bit annoyed with the timing. I mean, he presumably would have liked Europe to have consulted a bit more closely on when they announced this and how they made this offer.
But then again. I don't know is the answer to that. But it slightly worries me that at some point there is going to have to be some kind of pivot towards a position that says Brexit is not working. It's damaging us economically. Our number one mission is growth. We're going to have to address some of these issues. But I also think I hear so many young people saying they don't feel that the political parties understand them, care about them, get their issues and so forth. I think the Tories go on. I mean, that ridiculous David Frost had a piece the other day saying, you know, we've got to stop a Labour government, otherwise there's a risk of them undoing our greatest achievement, which was Brexit. I mean, if you're honestly saying Brexit was your greatest achievement, but the point is that it's got to be addressed at some point. We're going into the election where this is a massive elephant in the room.
One thing that I think we need to do more of, you know, people like you and me who want a much closer relationship with Europe and would like Labour to announce their rejoining the customs union immediately, et cetera, is to use some of the Brexiteers' words against them. Jacob Rees-Mogg's been out there saying, essentially, that the problem is that Brexit wasn't done right. But what he really means by that needs to be made clear, which is that they had a fantasy that once they left the European Union, they would go for this incredible kind of low tax, deregulated
Singapore on Thames.
Yeah, Singapore on Thames stuff. And of course, what has turned out to be the case is there's no support for that in Britain. I mean, people, broadly speaking, have a pretty socially democratic vision of their country. They want to continue to support the NHS. They're trying to, essentially support the kind of British values that have underlain the British state since the 40s. And so, and the other thing is that the Brexiteers were betting on a much closer relationship with China. They kept saying, you know, China's growing much more quickly than Europe. But of course, the whole security situation has changed since then. And now the whole push is to de-risk and decouple from places like China and to be closer to your nearest allies because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the whole world's changed since Brexit. Mm. I mean, somehow we're going to have to land that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I can honestly say that there is nothing that is going to stop me vote Labour in the next election. Okay. I am going to vote Labour in the next election. But I know quite a lot of people who are instinctively pro-Labour who, unless there is some sort of signal on some of these issues on which Labour are quiet, particularly Brexit and Europe, but also issues like, you know, the voting system, the political system and so forth, I think they're taking quite a lot of people for granted.
That's the problem, that the voters will feel that Labour thinks, oh, well, you know, kind of progressive liberals are going to vote for us anyway, so we don't have to do any policies for them.
Now, there is a question here. So there's me being very negative about Labour, one that will give me an opportunity to be a little bit more positive. Jenny, have the private railways failed passengers? Over the weekend, it was revealed that performance targets for train operators have seemingly been lowered in order to reward companies despite record cancellations and falling standards. Bosses and shareholders are taking home millions from the taxpayer. Is this waste of money acceptable? Now, we're recording this on Tuesday, and I think it's on Thursday that Louise Hague, who's the Shadow Transport Secretary, is setting out what sounds to me like quite an exciting thing, because I think we are going to get the promise of a new Railways Act in the First King's Speech, and at the heart, publicly owned, accountable, arm's length Great British Railways. Now, I don't know any more than that. I just know that. But I do think that our railways, every time I'm on a railway and a train, whether it's in Italy, it's in Germany, or it's France, or it's Scandinavia, they are just so much better than ours and cheaper. So I think if Labour have got a thought through plan to get a grip of our railways, the devil will be in the detail, but I'm very, very glad that it looks like it's going to be slammed right into the centre of the agenda.
I was quite proud of our piece that we did in our recent podcast on Canada. And I was talking to a Canadian politician who said, the way in which Canada's a bit like Britain is that it's a country that is really struggling to get its productivity sorted out, really struggling. It's sort of underperforming compared to places like the US and really beginning to worry about how it's going to fund public services, because without the growth in productivity, it's never getting the tax revenue to really keep going things that Canadians care deeply about, like their health service, et cetera. And that's, I think, the challenge, isn't it, for countries like Canada and Britain? Why are we underperforming? How do you turn this around? Because if you don't manage to turn it around, we're facing a horrible situation, because you're right, trains are a disgrace, but so's health.
Yeah.
Huge problems in education, prisons, and we just keep going, right? And that's going to be the really big, interesting challenge for Labour. Are they going to be able to deal with this?
On the health thing, I had a meeting with the Royal Free, my local hospital. There are these charities attached to them. And it was fascinating to talk to them about the extent to which the fundraising that they're involved in is helping to deliver really, really significant healthcare projects that you and I and most people probably think are just being paid for by the state. So, you know, you're absolutely right. These are all services that are going to face massive challenges. One of the other things I understand in this new Labour transport plan, which I think will be welcomed by people like Sadiq and Andy Burnham and the other elected mayors, is that they are going to give a bigger role within the rail network to the leaders of the devolved authorities as well. So all I know is what I've said to you, but I think it sounds quite an interesting move, and I think we'll you know, be another sort of flagship policy that Labour will be able to say makes them different to the Tories.
Very good. What's a jolly last one from you?
Okay, I've got one here, Rory. I've got one for you. Patsy Heller. I very much enjoyed the leading interview with Sadiq Khan, but I was disappointed by Rory's summary, which felt more negative than the interview himself. Surely he is not voting for Susan Hall. I think we should be told. Now, come on, Rory, you can't just keep sitting on fences. Your bum will get sore.
Gosh, it's really depressing. I mean, I ran against Sadiq Khan. So I obviously think there are problems with him as mayor. But I've been trying to work out who I would vote for in that election. So I got excited for a moment by the Green candidate. I mean, you know, we're getting through our doors in London at the moment, all this literature from different people. And I thought, well, maybe the Green candidate's the way to go. And then I read the Green candidates thing, and it was such sort of boring, bland, unconvincing
stuff.
Right,
so the Greens are out. Is Susan Hall out? Is she out of your reckoning?
I think it's unlikely I will vote for Susan Hall, yeah. but I'd be interested to see what people think, because I think it's a difficult thing to say, because I'm very, very, you know, I can see a lot to like about Sadiq Khan, but I don't think he's the world's greatest mayor. And I'm just a bit disappointed by the whole bunch of the candidates.
Rory, you can't, as a sort of somebody who's committed to politics as a vital part of our national life, you can't not vote.
No. Well, that's why I was looking at the Green. Anyway, don't.
And also, but it is in the end, because of this ridiculous new voting system, which you and I both think they shouldn't have allowed.
Yeah.
And which, in the end, it is the choice is Sadiq or Susan.
He loves this phrase. It's a two-horse race. He doesn't want people like me looking at people
so
like the Greens.
So which horse are you backing? You've got to back a horse, Rory. Patsy wants you to back a horse.
Go on. Go on. Here's my final thing. Stephen, should anyone above the age of 70 be allowed to vote? Alistair, you're a great one for young people voting. What do you think about old people voting?
I am a great one for young people, but when I'll be 70 in 3 years' time, so I hope I'll vote. I think there's a case for weighted voting. There definitely was a case for weighted voting in the Brexit referendum. Should have had three votes for 16 to 30, two votes for 30 to 60, and one vote for above 60. That would have been a great voting system.
I'm going to make a boring principled objection to that, which is democracy is based on the absolute equality of every individual and everybody having the same weight.
Yeah, but Rory, we live in unprecedented times. Unprecedented times.
All right. Okay, Alistair, thank you very much.
All the best.
Bye.